This is the Oanda Podcast, brought to you by Jazz FM's Business Breakfast.
Hello, this is the Oanda Market Insights Podcast, where we make sense of a week of financial and business news, and then across the world to the week ahead. I'm Nick Howard. Joining me is Oanda Senior Market Analyst Craig Earlham. Craig, good to speak to you as always. Let's kick off with the UK, which this week we've learned is now in over £2 trillion worth of public debt, a bigger sum than the country's GDP. Just to kick off, what impact does a number like that actually make?
Well, I mean, ordinarily, it would have a great impact. It's obviously quite significant. I think these are more headline makers, though, than they are actual difference makers, because whether it's 1.99 trillion or 2 trillion doesn't really make a difference. But if you're writing a story, obviously the shock factor of 2 trillion certainly becomes a much bigger deal.
Well, and the journalist's love of a big round number.
Exactly. I mean, I think we all do. Ultimately, we get quite attached to these big round numbers on a regular basis. It is still a big deal, but the difficulty we obviously have right now is that a lot of countries are seeing their debt balloon because we are in the midst of a global pandemic, and therefore many of these governments right now are being forced to spend a lot more cash than they were otherwise previously intending to do so. And this is coming after a decade when the mantra seems to have been actually it's fiscal responsibility which will get us back on track rather than fiscal splurges. And it seems that we've gone full 180, although this is naturally a very different crisis to what we've just previously dealt with.
You're right, we've lived through a decade of politicians setting out their stall on fiscal responsibility, on cutting the deficit, cutting public debt, and yet we're now going into a period where I suspect politicians are not going to be punished for the debt that they have run up in the same way that the previous generation of politicians were, because of the circumstances we find ourselves in.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you'd probably expect to find the opposite if politicians don't go to the extremes that they are currently doing. They'll actually be punished for not doing enough to support us during a completely unprecedented crisis that many of us will hopefully never have to deal with again. The measures which we've seen taken are the likes of which we are unlikely to be seen again. We're unlikely to see the kind of job support schemes that we've seen been put in place, subsidising salaries to the tune of 80%. We're unlikely. You look at the UK with the kind of Eat Out to Help Out, Help Out to Eat Out scheme. All of these things that we're seeing are very much unique to this particular issue. And as I say, you compare this to a decade ago. The crisis was viewed very differently. It was viewed as a crisis almost of our own making, not the general public per se, but of excess, which is what you've seen plenty of times in the past. And therefore, they obviously believed that it required a different solution. And that in itself is extremely up for debate. Whereas this is very different. This is a global pandemic, which has forced shops to close and forced healthy businesses to become potentially extremely unhealthy overnight, and forced potential mass unemployment on us, which needed intervention. So I think, yeah, this time it is that we are getting a completely different response from policymakers, and I think they'd have been very, very much punished had they not taken this exact response.
So from a financial point of view, what's interesting about these big numbers when it comes to public debt is the lack of impact it seems to have on government bonds. Do you think that we are going to see political policy over the next few years cutting debt? Or are you saying that we're going to be in these kind of debt levels for a while? What kind of impact would that have?
It's going to be really difficult because ultimately, again, we have seen governments around the world effectively looking to try and trim the fat off spending in order to try and regain that kind of that reduce those fiscal deficits, in order to try and turn a fiscal surplus, and in order to try and reduce debt that way. And again, there's very much up to debate how much you've been trimming the fat and how much has been actually hitting the flesh. But the problem that they have is that there is no real more. The argument that there's more fat to just continue to trim isn't really a sustainable argument. So I do think there may actually be efforts to grow our way out of this problem. And I know my colleague in over in Jakarta, Jeff, who's been on the podcast before, it seems to be a firm believer that it's actually going to be, there's going to be attempts to try and almost inflate our way out of this issue, which brings obviously problems itself. But I don't think the same approach to the last crisis in terms of debt reduction is going to be useful this time, just simply because if there was an enormous amount of fat left to be trimmed, I think they would have tried to do that over the course of the last decade. You'd have to wonder where it is exactly they can make those cost savings. I think this time it's going to have to be a case of the more people you have in work, the better chance that we have of actually reducing our debt. And it's just going to have to accept that debt levels aren't going to be at 60% of GDP for an awfully long time, and that central banks are going to remain accommodative for an awfully long time. Because what's made this doable, what's kept bond yields low, is the fact that there is an enormous amount of liquidity floating around the system. We've got trillions of dollars of central bank support flowing around the system, which has enabled yields to stay low intentionally. And I think policymakers are going to have to accept that that kind of support is going to have to remain here for a sustainable amount of time.
I do have more that I want to talk about in terms of UK stories this week, but let's stay with that point about inflation. So OPEC have essentially called for the status quo to remain when it comes to oil production, because they feel that the use of oil is going to be up to almost 100% of where it was before the pandemic by the end of the year, which strikes me as remarkable, but obviously is going to have its own effect on where inflation goes.
Yes, it strikes me as remarkable as well and overly optimistic. They are the experts in this rather than myself, although it is worth noting that those same experts started an oil price war just before the pandemic hit, and that was going to create problems of its own, even not taking into account the pandemic. I'm not obviously criticising them for not foreseeing this. None of us did. But they said that they think that it's going to get up to 97% of pre-pandemic levels. I find that extremely hard to believe, especially with the kind of spikes in the COVID numbers that we're seeing, the impact that it's having on air travel already. You look at the quarantine measures that have been imposed. The IEA have a slightly different view on this as well. But OPEC, more importantly, or OPEC Plus, the group of OPEC Plus, other non-OPEC members, including Russia, are taking a very slow and steady approach. They've seen that US production has fallen quite considerably now, and they are taking a slow and steady approach. They previously cut production by 9.7 million barrels a day. That was taking around 10% off of global oil supply. They've increased that now by 2 million barrels. So they're still 7.7 million barrels a day shy of their pre-pandemic levels. And I think they're going to be very cautious. And ultimately, what they decided at this meeting this week was that they are going to take a very cautious approach. They're not going to change this at this moment in time. They're going to see where they are in September. They're having a meeting around the same time next month. And that effectively what they're going to do in that time is just continue to monitor. And if they see a reason to raise production again, then they will do so. But until then, there's just going to be a few countries whose output is going to rise slightly. And the only reason for that is to offset effectively the levels that they didn't meet after the last production cut. So we're talking about a slight increase from Iraq, Nigeria, Angola and Kazakhstan. But broadly speaking, it's going to be at a cut of 7.7 million barrels a day for at least another month. And as we know, the situation with the pandemic, it's evolving every day. We've seen now quarantine measures imposed from the UK, for example, on France, on Spain, on Croatia as of this weekend. And it wouldn't surprise me if other countries going to follow, given the spikes that we're now seeing in Germany and in Italy and other countries as well. This is all going to have an impact on demand. And if we see further economic restrictions being imposed in these countries with spikes, then again, this is going to take its toll as well. This is an ever-evolving story, unfortunately, and we can only hope that these second spikes are far less severe each and every time.
Well, where do you actually see Europe at the moment? Because as well as those record infection rates in places like Germany and France in the last few days, we've also seen some fairly ropey PMI data coming out of the continent. I would say that it's only going to get worse if more people have to go back into lockdown, if more people are infected.
Yeah, so I think there's a few different angles really to take on this. One is the fact that one of the reasons why we've seen these numbers pull back is because the initial bounce after once the factories and the shops started reopening was quite extreme. You had almost this pent-up demand that had to be used up, and that had a positive impact on these figures. Obviously, once you start to see that fade, then it starts that has the opposite impact as well. Obviously, then you've had the kind of second surges, and that's going to create a little bit of uncertainty. The employment aspect of the report as well suggested that people are being laid off, so that's a concern for the coming months for the region. We could see a spike in unemployment as well if these figures, if the indication from these figures prove to be accurate. Obviously, it's going to be a challenging period. The one thing I'd always say with the PMIs is they're an extremely volatile reading, so they can be dramatically different from month to month. The UK's figures, for example, were very good, but then we're almost, it feels like, a month behind Europe because we were late going into lockdown, we were later coming out of lockdown, so maybe we're still seeing that kind of post-lockdown bounce, so maybe next month we'll start to see a similar impact here in the UK. They're very volatile. I think that's what I'd say. I think broadly speaking, Europe's going to be looking at the situation and saying they're still relatively comfortable with how everything's progressing. Yes, we're seeing a spike in numbers. That was inevitable when you remove the lockdown measures. What you want to see is how well that can be controlled, how quickly it can be controlled, and also who's being affected by it. Because if the infections are rising more so, as we're seeing amongst the younger population, and therefore the hospital rates are still low and the death rates is much lower as a result, then there will be more and more lessons to learn over the course of the next few months in terms of what it is that we can and can't do.
Now, the latest round of Brexit negotiations have just completed. Both sides are briefing to the media that nothing has changed and it's all the other side's fault. I think it's actually worth just reminding ourselves where we are here. So the UK left the EU at the end of January. This is the transition period. This is about what happens next. And really, we're talking about the same issues that we have for a few years. What happens with fishing? How closely aligned are the UK and the EU on regulations for various industries? Can the UK subsidise its industries? And these are big technical issues that really are never going to be solved by negotiators. This needs political intervention. I suppose I'm asking, both sides, the politicians, have bigger things to worry about right now. Do you see that kind of intervention coming to actually break the logjam?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think a no deal solution was always the worst solution. Even to begin with, and that was before the pandemic and before we had the economic consequences which come with that. It's an even worse solution now for both sides from a purely economic standpoint. So I do think there is going to be intervention eventually. I think obviously you called it last week. This was never going to be as straightforward as saying Monday we're going to discuss fisheries and level playing field. Friday we've done it. We've drawn a line under it. Now we can move on to the easy parts of the agreement. It was never going to move like that. There's always going to be disagreements and there's always going to be certain things which are going to be left to the end, and then you start to almost pair them off and try and come to a negotiated agreement on the various issues, and you can see which ones are going to be in that kind of ballpark. The UK seems optimistic that a deal can still be reached in September. The EU has said that a deal has to be reached by the end of October in order to give it time to be ratified across the 27 other governments and obviously the European Parliament. So naturally, there's going to be crunch talks in November between Boris Johnson and whoever else to try and get these final issues sorted out. The UK, I believe, has tried to kind of offer a kind of draft a fair trade agreement with the EU and has passed that on to Michel Barnier today, although it's not been confirmed, to try and break the deadlock. That doesn't seem to have been taken particularly well, because as far as the EU is concerned, it's these other hard issues that need to be resolved before we can move on to the other things. So again, it's the same old story, let's face it. We've been saying these exact same things for almost 4 years now.
I don't think I'm alone in thinking, like you, that there will be a deal by the end of the year. I suppose my interest is in how politicians, and also, I suppose, the general public, distinguish between a good deal and a bad deal. I mean, we're talking about incredibly complicated issues. How will we know that we've actually got something worthwhile here?
I don't think we will. I think I think both sides will sell any eventual deal as a good deal because it's not in any of their political interest to say that we've got a raw deal out of this. Both sides will probably claim that they've got a slightly better deal than the other side, and I think that's probably going to be particularly true from the European side, because the last thing they want to do is say the UK voted to leave, we've negotiated for a long time and they've got a cracking deal. So whatever happens, I think they'll want to perceive this to be they've got a decent deal under the circumstances, but it's not as good as actually being a member. And I think the people who voted for Brexit all those years ago will see anything as a good deal, because in their eyes they'll have left the European Union, they'll have got all of the freedoms which come with leaving the European Union, like striking free trade deals, and like having control over their own legal system, etc., etc., and that everyone will kind of walk away and say, to be honest, whether I like this or loathe it, I'm just glad it's over and let's move on with our lives, because I think a lot of people have been waiting to move on with their lives for an awfully long time. And granted, we've said
cynical,
before,
but do you think that the end of this year and the signing of whatever deal is done will be the end of the matter?
No, I don't, but I think once the UK has left the EU and a no deal Brexit has been avoided, then as far as most of the general public on both sides of the water are concerned, that's effectively a line drawn under it. And then it's for lawmakers all over the EU and in the UK to deal with the other more less interesting pieces that ensure that any agreement functions to ensure that any disputes are resolved properly as per the whatever mechanisms are agreed in the interim. I think from a public perspective, it's effectively done and dusted when the EU, when the UK leaves the EU with a deal in place. And after that, it's just not going to be something of interest anymore.
Let's stick with the politics and move now to the US. We've had the Democratic National Convention in Delaware this week, a very odd affair because of coronavirus, politicians and their supporters speaking in a darkened and empty convention hall compared to the rallies and party atmosphere that you would perhaps get in previous years. But we've heard now from Joe Biden, the Democrat Party presidential candidate, and his vice presidential nominee, Kamala Harris. And then next week, we will be hearing from President Trump at the Republicans' convention. It feels as though we've been watching this political battle for years now. It's almost hard to believe that the election is nearly upon us. Is this of any interest, I suppose, in terms of you and markets, or is it merely a sideshow at this point?
I think it is. I think it's certainly of interest. I think the pandemic overshadows everything. So unfortunately, it just becomes maybe slightly less of a big deal than you would otherwise think. And I think also from a markets perspective, it's funny. It's interesting the view that seems to be taken towards Biden compared to what may have previously been taken. You're almost seeing a kind of fatigue potentially with this kind of ongoing spat with China, the ongoing uncertainty it causes. And I think you're hearing a lot more noises now. And it's always difficult to tell until after the election what people actually think. But you're hearing a lot more noises now of, do you know what, Biden wouldn't be such a bad thing. Yes, he'd raise corporation taxes. And yes, he'd probably raise taxes for the highest earners. But you would bring a certain amount of stability with that, which we haven't had now for the last 4 years. So what that tells me is that regardless of who wins this election, there may not be too severe an impact on the markets. And I may be wrong, because it was only 4 years ago that people were saying that a Trump victory could be very negative for the markets because of the trade wars, because of everything else that comes with the Trump presidency. And the immediate response in the markets was a big sell-off. And within 24 hours, that had reversed course. And we've all seen what's happened in the stock market since. It's amazing what cutting taxes will do for a stock market rally. So it's always going to be difficult to say. Again, you could look at maybe it's some of the more intricate things which is going to have a greater impact. For example, will the Democrats get the Senate if Joe Biden wins? If the Democrats effectively sweep the presidency and the House and the Senate, then you could see maybe a slightly stronger reaction because there's more that they will be able to do. Whereas a split Congress may satisfy the markets a little bit more because it means that Biden will be a little bit more hamstrung. It's always going to be difficult to say at this point. And also, like, so this is coming against the backdrop of a pandemic, which is overarching no matter what the issue.
Before I let you go, Craig, what are we looking ahead to next week?
Yeah, so next week, again, it's a little bit quiet in terms of these kind of major economic events. We've got a lot of low and medium tier economic data. I think the standout event next week is probably the Jackson Hole Symposium. It's going to be virtual this year round for obvious reasons. So you may see a little bit less of the kind of thing that we typically see around the actual event itself. And there's going to be a lot more focus around what certain policymakers are going to say. You've got, for example, Andrew Bailey from the Bank of England speaking. The headline event is always going to be the Fed chair speaking, so that's going to be Jerome Powell, I think, on Thursday and on Friday. So we're going to see a lot of focus on that. And given how active central banks have been over the course of this pandemic and how important they've been as a backbone of these entire financial markets, I think people are going to be following these very closely. As we already saw this week, for example, the Fed minutes were not too out there. There wasn't anything too extreme that happened in these minutes, but it did have probably an outsized market impact under the circumstances, and it shows the kind of sensitivity that we have to central banks still. But I think that's the major one for next week. We've got to remember, we are still in the summer. It's been quite a slow week already this week so far. Like I say, a few minutes from the RBA, the ECB and the Fed, there wasn't really anything too much to take away from there, and the data wasn't really knockout. Like I said, same for next week. The biggest story this week was Apple hitting $2 trillion, which is a monumental moment in itself. But as I said earlier with the kind of UK and the numbers thing, it's nothing fundamentally changes when these landmarks are hit. But you can always tell it's always a gauge of what's happening that week when it's as big a story as it is.
Craig, let's leave it there. Always a pleasure speaking with you. That's Craig Earlham, Senior Market Analyst at OANDA. This is the OANDA Market Insights Podcast, available from iTunes and anywhere you get podcasts. I'm Nick Howard. Join us again when we speak next week.
Was the OANDA podcast from the team behind Jazz FM's Business Breakfast, a daily early morning 30-minute briefing for the day ahead. On air from 6 a.m. Listen to Jazz FM on DAB, online, or just ask Alexa.